El Paso, Texas, October 2nd, 1881. The ride from San Antonio had been almost 600 miles, and Wes had taken his time, sparing his horse. He arrived on Sunday afternoon, and following a bountiful meal at a cafe, went looking for Granny Boudlow's boarding house. He stepped through the front door and encountered a very pretty girl.
I reckon you ain't Granny.
No, I ain't. I'm Molly Harrell, Granny's partner. Do you want her, or will I do?
Much as I want to meet Granny, I can wait. I'm Wes Tremaine, and I want a room.
All right. Day, week, or month?
A month. I like the surroundings.
Well, meals, breakfast, and supper are 50 cents a day extra.
I'll take the meals, too.
All right. Well, breakfast is at 7, and supper's at 5. There's fried chicken tonight.
I'll be there at 4:30.
Well, I'll show you to your room. Oh, unless you need to tend to your horse.
My horse is at the livery. I always see to him first. Do I look that much like a shorthorn?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize how that sounded. Come on, and I'll show you to your room.
Granny Boudlow came down the front hall.
Granny, this is Wes Tremaine. He'll be staying with us for a month. Mr. Tremaine, this is Granny Boudlow.
For a long moment, Granny looked critically at Wes.
I see you somewhere before.
I've never been in El Paso in my life until now.
Supper at Granny Boudlow's was an interesting affair. Including Wes, Granny had a total of 15 boarders, all of them men. Several were drummers, but most of the others appeared to be clerks from the shops in town. Wes had wondered how he'd recognize Jim Gillett, but Molly Harrell took care of that. When everybody was seated at the long table, she introduced them to Wes and Wes to them. Jim Gillett only nodded, and there wasn't a thing to draw undue attention to him. Gillett seemed in no hurry, nor did Wes, but they finished within seconds of one another. When Gillett started down the hall, Wes followed. Concealed in his hand, Wes had the Star in a Circle shield of the Texas Rangers, and when he caught up to Gillett, he flashed the badge.
Follow me. I'm in room number 9.
The two had already been introduced, but when Gillett offered his hand, Wes shook it. Gillett stood an inch or two over 6 feet, with gray eyes and hair black as a crow's wing. He looked to be maybe 25. He sat down on the bed while Wes took the only chair.
I reckon you was told about the situation here before you left San Antone?
Some. Why don't you tell me how you see it?
Was I you? I wouldn't walk too close to Studenmire. The varmint just naturally attracts enemies like a tall oak draws lightning bolts.
I was told there was trouble between Anglos and Mexicans. Does Studenmire figure into that?
To some extent. He sure don't like him, and right after he became city marshal, he shot one in the back.
Accidentally, I heard.
I don't doubt that. He carries 3 guns, including a hideout, and he ain't the world's best shot even when he's sober. He's got a running feud going with the Manning brothers, and he's always where anybody can get at him. He operates the Globe Restaurant, the place his brother-in-law willed him. It'd be damn easy to bushwhack him just any day or night you could choose.
We're not here to save Studenmire from being dry-gulched, and there's nothing we can do to keep Anglos and Mexicans from hating one another. Exactly why are we here?
We're here to prevent a total breakdown of law and order. Rangers in town have a calming effect, but we don't want to have our presence known until the need arises. During the next few days, spend some time in the Globe Restaurant and get acquainted with Dallas Studenmire. Then you'll have some better idea as to why people in this town are getting spooked.
Santa Fe, New Mexico, November 5th, 1881. With Empty trotting beside him, Nathan reached the U.S. Marshal's office just as Blanchard and 4 deputies arrived.
Stone, these are Deputies Pryor, Soule, Wells, and Lytle. We'll ride by delivery for the mules and harness. How you fixed for grub?
Enough in my saddlebag for 3 days. When we've recovered the wagon, I'll have to ride back to Santa Fe ahead of you. I've got to ride to Pueblo and take the train to Dodge City for a meeting there.
Let's ride then. How far to the wagon?
Unless they've moved it, maybe 150 miles. We won't reach it until sometime tomorrow.
Just before noon of their second day on the trail, with Nathan in the lead, the posse reined up.
We're not more than an hour away from where I left the wagon. Let's rest the horses here and let my dog range on ahead. He'll warn us if there's an ambush.
From what you've told me, that's what I expect. If this bunch went to the trouble of killing a military escort in South Texas, they're not likely to back off at this point. Their only way out is to kill all of us.
Well, they're not going to do that. An ambush is effective only when it's a total surprise.
Empty returned a few minutes later.
Well?
They're waiting for us. All of you wait here. I'll follow Empty and see where they're holed up. Then we'll go after them.
They didn't question him, and Nathan rode away, following Empty. He rode on, reining up when Empty came back to meet him. He then followed the dog on foot. When he eventually saw the wagon, it had definitely been moved, for it sat in a clearing. There was no sign of the mules. Beyond the clearing to the south was a rise. At various points along the slope and near the foot of it were upthrusts of stone, every one large enough to conceal a man with a gun. Nathan watched from the brush, not having revealed himself. It would be simple enough to send three men to the east and three to the west, bringing them in behind those who lay in wait, setting up a murderous crossfire. Nathan made his way back to his horse, mounted, and then rode back to meet the posse.
We can divide our forces, swing wide to east and west, and flank them. They're bellied down behind some rocks beyond the wagon. You're representing the law, Marshal. When we have them covered, call on them to surrender.
They ain't likely to. What then?
We shoot. These are thieves and killers. And you have federal John Doe warrants for their arrest. I can get them changed to execution warrants if need be. I don't like John Doe execution warrants if there's any doubt, but I have none. Marshal, you take two men and ride to the east. I'll take two and go west. Give us half an hour to get into position and then call out your challenge. Just be sure you're in range, and if they don't surrender, shoot.
Pryor, you and Sol come with me.
They rode out, and Nathan nodded to Wells and Lytle. They followed him as he rode to the west, swinging wide to avoid the ambush ahead. They came out on the southern slope of the ridge, and there they left their horses. There was plenty of cover, and Nathan led them far enough that they could see several of the men who lay in wait. Nathan couldn't see Blanchard and his men, but it stood to reason they should be in position.
This is Deputy U.S. Marshal Jim Blanchard. You people are under arrest. Drop your weapons and come out with your hands up.
Nathan was the first to fire. There was a crash of gunfire from Blanchard's position.
This is Andre Lamie. My wife and I are unarmed. We're done.
Come on, but keep your hands up.
Slowly they came up the slope, their hands shoulder high. Nathan met back up with Blanchard.
We're glad to see you, Marshal. Those men have been holding us against our will.
Tell it to the judge. I know what's in that wagon over yonder. It was taken from an army escort and six soldiers were killed. The army's wiring me more information, and I reckon they'll be wanting to question you folks. Pryor, you and Sol find the horses that belong to this bunch. We'll need two of them.
We'd better see if any of those other four varmints are still alive. If it's all the same to the rest of you, Empty and me will take a look.
By all means.
Empty went ahead of him, and he went on down the slope. Three of the men were dead, and a fourth had been gut shot. Nathan went to the wagon, opened the canvas pucker, and looked inside. Nothing had been bothered, as best he could tell. He walked back up the slope. Pryor and Sol had found the horses belonging to the outlaws and had brought two of them for Andre and Kit Lamie.
Three of the men are dead, and the fourth won't be around for long.
Wells, you and Lytle get those mules harnessed to that wagon.
You don't have anything on us. We were traveling with those men against our will.
Well, that's not what you told me. You and the Wampus Kitty were bossing those fake soldiers around like you owned them, and I had to kill two of them just to get away from you. I reckon you don't know anything about that wagon load of explosives, either.
We've never seen you before in our lives, and we have absolutely no idea what's in that wagon. It'll be your word against ours.
We'll be getting a telegraph report and descriptions from federal authorities. Maybe we can refresh your memory.
Pryor, you'll take first turn with the wagon. One of the others will spell you after a couple of hours. You gotta take it slow, avoiding rocks and drop-offs.
Lytle waved his hat, indicating the mules were hitched and the wagon was ready to go. Blanchard nodded to Pryor and Sol as they rode out, Andre and Kit Lamie ahead of them. Blanchard had held back to speak to Nathan.
Stone, I don't doubt that pair's everything you say they are, but you'd heard what they said. They're slick as calf slobber, and if it's going to be your word against theirs, I want you around till I got this nailed down. They're slick-tongued lawyers that could get them off scot-free and leave me looking like a prime fool.
I understand your position, and I won't leave Santa Fe until you have the evidence you need. Since I telegraphed Washington and got all this started, I'll have to see it through. I'm sure the government wants that nitroglycerin, but if a soldier escort was murdered, somebody will have to account for that.
I'll feel a lot better when we get some official word as to what happened. Have you considered how all this is going to look if that wagon is loaded with nothing but French wine?
I've thought of the possibility. But nothing that's happened makes any sense if there's anything less than nitroglycerin in that wagon. I can't imagine them trying to kill me over a wagon load of wine. And you were right in the midst of a fight to the death today. I think we're going to find some dead men on their back trail.
Well, let's get on back to Santa Fe and see if anything's come in on the telegraph.
Santa Fe, New Mexico, November 20th, 1881. The return to Santa Fe was slow and laborious because of the heavily loaded wagon and the need to avoid rough terrain. Nathan and Blanchard went immediately to the telegraph office.
Oh, I'd never seen so much telegraph business.
The telegrapher brought out a sheaf of yellow paper on which he'd scribbled messages. Every one had been dated, and he handed them to Blanchard.
You have them dated and in order. Good.
Spread them out on the table over yonder. If you got trouble reading my writing, maybe I can figure it out.
This is what I'm wanting to see. It covers the killing of the soldier escort near Galveston Bay and backs up what you said about this bunch stealing the load of nitroglycerin.
And what about descriptions?
We're coming to that, I think. Here, read some of this.
Tarnation, this bunch has been in trouble with the law before. Andre and Kit Lemie have used a whole passel of names. All the hombres they had posing as soldiers were killers. They're all wanted in Texas.
This is looking more solid all the time. We got to supply our sworn testimony that these six men actually died. You got to account for the two you shot, and we can all testify to the killing of the other four that tried to ambush us. The military will be sending for any that we took alive.
I think we ought to telegraph Washington that six of the bunch are dead, and that the Lemies, or whoever they are, have been locked up. I expect there'll be soldiers from Fort Elliott, Texas, or from Fort Dodge, Kansas, coming to take this Lemie pair off your hands. I reckon you'll get some recognition from this.
I don't figure I'm due any. It was you that started all this.
Well, I don't want any credit. I was able to get Washington involved only because these people had committed crimes against the United States, and because I have a friend in the Attorney General's office. It's no more than he would expect of me. And when you get the final word as to how this will be resolved, I'll be riding on.
When Blanchard telegraphed Washington that the nitroglycerin had been recovered and that Andre and Kit Lemie were in custody, the response was rapid and brief.
Suspects in custody being extradited to Texas. Stop. Military escort coming from Fort Elliott to claim recovered federal property and suspects. Stop. Byron Silver.
Well, it's time I was riding on. You have my sworn testimony.
Go ahead. I'm satisfied we've handled this properly.
Nathan had one more telegram to send. It was addressed to 21, Office of the Attorney General, Washington.
We'll meet you in Dodge December 1st.
He paid for the telegram, and with empty following, he rode north toward Pueblo. Wes Tremaine didn't talk to Jim Gillett for almost a week. The second conversation came about after a raid by the Sandlin gang, when a Mexican wrangler was killed. Gillett nodded to Wes in the hall after supper, and they went on to Gillett's room.
Now, I reckon you heard about the outlaw raid on the Collier Ranch yesterday.
Yeah, I heard. I reckon the killing of another Mexican won't help the situation around here.
It won't change anything one way or another. I figured this would be as good a time as any to tell you about the Sandlin gang. Cord Sandlin built himself an empire across the border, just beyond Ciudad Juarez, and El Paso's come to expect a certain amount of hell-raising from him. I understand he's bought off the Mexican authorities, and he has an outlaw band of more than 30 men.
There's law on this side of the border. Why hasn't nobody stood up to Sandlin and his bunch?
Well, somebody has. 5 years ago, before I came here, they murdered Sheriff McCormick.
I reckon nobody's challenged them since then.
No, and with good reason. Not a man in this town is willing to join a sheriff's posse right after the Sandlin gang. Sandlin's got word out that any man going after the gang would be marked for death, including the county sheriff or city marshal.
Maybe he's bluffing.
Sheriff McCormick gambled on that, and all it got him was a 6-foot hole in the bone orchard.
Sandlin has his way because everybody's afraid of him, including the Rangers.
Hell, kid, that Ranger star couldn't make a man bulletproof. In case you ain't been told, you're not allowed to cross the border after outlaws. Some kind of border deal between the United States and Mexico. If that ain't reason enough to stay the hell out of the land of chili peppers, Sandlin's come up with a stronger one. He's put a bounty of $100 on any lawman crossing the river. Many a Mex would backshoot his own brother for that kind of money.
You're not very inspiring, Gillett.
I don't aim to be. Don't ever let noble thoughts get the best of your common sense. Get yourself gunned down in a fight you can't win, and within 6 months, nobody on either side of the border will remember or care who you were.
I'll keep that in mind. Anything else?
Only what I suggested last time. Spend some time in the globe and get to know Dallas Studenmeier.
So I inherit him when you leave?
Not just him. The whole damn town. My resignation is effective the day after Christmas.
El Paso, Texas, December 16th, 1881. Wes awoke in the small hours of the morning. In his sock feet, he crossed the hall and tapped on Gillett's door. Except for his boots, Gillett was dressed.
I reckon you heard the shooting?
I heard it, but you'll have to get used to that. It's the city marshal's job. Rangers don't enforce town law unless we're called in for that purpose, and that's not our reason for being here. There are exceptions, of course. If somebody's shot and killed Studenmeier, then we'll have to restore and maintain the peace until a new town marshal is appointed. It's after 3 o'clock, and our presence in town would only reveal us without serving any purpose. We'll skip Granny's breakfast and eat at the Globe. Whatever took place this morning will be the topic of conversation.
When Wes and Gillett reached the Globe, the place was crowded, and they soon discovered the reason. Seated at a table with a dozen other men, Studenmeier was recounting what had happened during the night.
It happened outside my boarding house. About 3 o'clock this morning, some vermin tried to ambush me, and I'd have got him, but he was so close his muzzle flashes blinded me. I cut down on him, but he got away in the dark.
Wes and Gillett finished their breakfast and moved out into the streets.
That's pretty much how it is with him. Not a whole lot of facts. Nobody will ever be sure whether Studenmeier fought his way out of an attempted ambush or whether he was just drunk and shooting at shadows.
Pueblo, Colorado, November 23rd, 1881. Nathan went to the railroad depot and arranged for a boxcar for his horse as far as Dodge on the next eastbound, which would depart at 6 o'clock the next morning. Reaching the bunkhouse, the first man Nathan encountered was Harley Stafford.
Well, by God, I thought you was through riding anything that didn't have four legs and a tail.
I thought so, too, but I'm as fiddle-footed as you are. I miss the locomotive whistles, riding the rails, shooting and being shot at.
Vivian didn't raise hell when you left?
No, she said all men are no damn good, that you and me are birds of a feather.
Damn, I don't know whether to be flattered or insulted.
She never understood why you rode away, but I did. A woman wants ties, but to a man they become chains. When I left New Orleans, I felt like I'd just broke jail.
I've never heard it said any better than that. I'll be taking the eastbound with you as far as Dodge.
And if you're after your old job, you'll have to fight me for it.
Relax, I'm meeting a friend there.
I won't tell Vivian.
Well, send her a telegram, I don't care. And I'm sure she won't.
Aw, hell, I was hoping to see her a little jealous. Now, we'll never find out if she cares a damn for anything or anybody but them fast horses.
You'll have to conduct your experiments without me. The last thing I want is a jealous female tied to my shirt tail.
I'll drink to that. We got the rest of today and tonight. Let's have us a big supper and then visit all the saloons.
Well, my dog doesn't like saloons.
Leave him at the depot with the dispatcher.
Well, he doesn't like trains, and I doubt he's all that fond of the dispatcher.
How's he going to get to Dodge? Lope alongside the train?
Except for saloons, he'll go where I go. We'll get supper and then go from there.
Nathan and Harley spent a little while at the cafe, then went back to the bunkhouse. They arose at 4 o'clock the following morning, had breakfast, and were ready when the eastbound left at 6. The train rattled across the plains, bound for Dodge City, 5 hours away.
How are things with the railroad?
Better than usual. We haven't had a train robbery since I came back.
Is Foster Hagerman still in the saddle at Dodge?
So far as the railroad's concerned, but he quit the town council. That affair with Wyatt Earp's policeman did it.
Earp, two of his brothers, and Doc Holliday started a shootout at Tombstone, Arizona back in October. They killed 3 men.
I read about that. It made the papers in Kansas City. Sounds like the Earps and Holliday finally done something right.
Dodge City, Kansas, November 24th, 1881. Nathan checked into the Dodge house, and he and Harley met Foster Hagerman at Delmonico's.
Nathan, I received a telegram from Byron Silver. He's in Kansas City, and you're to meet him there as soon as you can. He'll leave word with the dispatcher as to where you can find him.
If my memory serves me right, there won't be another eastbound until 11 o'clock tomorrow.
Right. So let's settle down, have us a steak with plenty of onions, potatoes, coffee, and apple pie.
When they were down to final cups of coffee, Nathan brought up a subject he'd been mulling over for a while.
There'll come a time when I may have to ask one of you to do a favor for me. And I'd like your promise that, should it become necessary, you'll do it.
Well, you've got my promise.
And mine.
My friends are scattered all over. And when I've ridden that last trail, I'd want them to know I've cashed in, gone west.
Hell, you're still a young man.
A slug has no respect for youth. I only want you to send telegrams, and there's just two words you'll have to remember. Omega 3.
Omega's the last word in the Greek alphabet, but why the 3?
That's a location. If it happens around here, I want you to send the message to Silver in Washington, to Barnabas McQueen in New Orleans, and to a girl, Molly Harrell, in El Paso. Before the need arises, all of them will be given the same message I'm giving you. Then, if I take the fall far away from here, you'll have someone who can tell you what became of me. If you receive a message that reads Omega 1, you'll know to contact McQueen in New Orleans. If it reads Omega 2, you'll know to contact Molly Harrell in El Paso. Either of you will be Omega 3, while Silver is Omega 4.
My God, Nathan. Sounds like you know something we don't.
No, I'm just accepting something you don't want to accept. I am to hold Silver to this same promise because I never know when I'll cash in running some errand for him. I don't want my bones bleaching on some lonesome trail without my few friends knowing where I am and what became of me.
Well, he has another of those errands waiting for you. That's why you'll be meeting him in Kansas City. You're the only man I know who works for nothing for the government.
Well, I'm not working for the government. I'm doing a favor for a friend.
The evening ended on a somber note, and Nathan and Harley returned to their rooms at the Dodge House. The next morning, by the time Harley and Nathan reached Delmonico's for breakfast, Foster Hagerman was already there, drinking coffee and ready to greet them.
Oh, it's not often I get to eat in such good company, so I'm taking full advantage of it.
Nathan, in your travels, have you come across a young hombre named Wesley Tremaine? Kid can't be a day over 16 if he's that, and he's chain lightning with a colt.
I haven't met him. It's an unusual name that I've heard only once, and that was long ago. What does he mean to you?
Well, he was kind of special to us both. He rode a freight in here, green as grass, with nothing but the clothes on his back. Vic Irwin hired him as a swamper at the Alhambra Saloon. Harley met him there and talked me into hiring him as a baggage clerk. Harley also taught him Morse code and how to use a gun, and I promoted him to railroad security. He killed some hombres that needed killing, including a pair that held up a train, and people started hounding him, testing his fast gun. Newspaper men started meeting the trains, hoping to see him shoot somebody. The kid had a horse and had learned to ride, and one night he just rode away, and we haven't seen him since.
I kind of know how he felt. I've had to shoot men I've never laid eyes on before just to keep them from shooting me. There are men all over the frontier who'd give 5 years of their lives for a shot at me. In the back, if necessary.
I hope you meet him one day. I saw him kill a man, his first, on the street here in Dodge, and he reminded me of you. He wasn't the least bit afraid, and his eyes, my God, they looked for the world like blue ice.
If we ever meet, I hope it's on friendly terms. I have more than enough hombres gunning for me.
Kansas City, Missouri, November 25th, 1881. Nathan called on the dispatcher, and the message he was given was brief.
Kansas City Hotel, 9.
Nathan left empty at the livery and went to the hotel.
Identify yourself.
Nathan Stone, your old compadre. You must have something almighty important cooking. I told you I'd be in Dodge December 1st.
I know, but I counted on you being curious enough to get there a week early, which you did. I decided there was no point in me going to Dodge when you could just as easily come here. Anyway, I'd like you to do some investigating, and it will take you into Missouri. I suppose you're familiar with Jesse James?
I should be. Jesse threatened to shoot me if we ever meet again.
Well, you never told me about that.
I didn't want you lying awake nights worrying about me. I kind of got in the way back in Nevada, Missouri during a bank robbery. Frank and Jesse ended up without a dollar and with a posse on their trail.
I can see how that might have upset them. With Jesse threatening to shoot you, what I'm about to say may sound a bit strange. I'd like you to help us track him down and, if possible, take him alive.
Tarnation. Why can't you ever come up with something easy, such as turning lead into gold ingots? How can you expect to take Jesse James alive when there's a $10,000 bounty on him, dead or alive?
The reward is being offered by Governor Thomas Crittenden, and that is a problem. While the state of Missouri only wants him out of circulation by any means, the Treasury of the United States would like him taken alive. Much of the money he's taken from train robberies was intended for government outposts, military payrolls and such. The Treasury believes Jesse has most of this money squirreled away somewhere, and that if he is taken alive, they might plea bargain for its return.
And just how the hell am I supposed to take Jesse James alive?
You're not expected to do that. We know he's holed up somewhere in Missouri, and all we want you to do is tell us where. Governor Crittenden is cooperating with us, but not to the extent he's willing to back off on the reward. There'll be 100 men ready to ride when we hear from you.
How much time do I have?
We don't know. Almost daily, there are telegrams seeking to claim the reward from people who are willing to produce a dead body. $10,000 could tempt a man's own family. Judas sold out for 30 pieces of silver.
I trailed the James gang once. That was after they'd robbed a bank and I had a trail to follow. When was their most recent robbery?
4 months ago. On July 15th, they boarded a Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific train at a stop just outside of Kansas City. They killed 2 men, including a conductor, forced their way into the express car, and pistol-whipped the messenger. They took his key, emptied the safe, and disappeared into the darkness.
No more recent robberies?
None that we know of. In fact, this is the only robbery attributed to Frank and Jesse since the shootout at Northfield, where they got nothing and 3 of the youngers were captured.
So they could be anywhere, not just in Missouri.
Yes, but they have friends in Missouri. They are literally thousands of God-fearing people who would hide Frank and Jesse and would consider it an honor. I realize what I'm asking will be difficult, if not impossible. I'm only asking that you try.
I'm willing to do that, but before I do, I want to ask a favor of you. Well, not for now, but later.
If it's within my power, you know I'll do it.
It's within your power. All it will involve is 3 telegrams. Just remember that you're Omega 4, and you'll be contacting Omega 1, 2, and 3.
He then told Silver what he had told Harley Stafford and Foster Hagerman.
Omega 1, 2, and 3 is McQueen in New Orleans, Molly Harrell in El Paso, and Harley Stafford or Foster Hagerman in Dodge.
Right, and each of them will be told to telegraph you. The Omega code will tell you where I am, or was.
You're serious, aren't you?
Never more serious in my life. Every man is born with the seeds of death within him. All that's lacking is the time and place.
When this Jesse James thing is behind us, why don't we travel down to the McQueen's place in New Orleans and spend some time there?
I have a good reason for not going there. Her name's Vivian Stafford. She's Harley's sister, and she traveled with me for a while. I don't want to kick any sleeping dogs, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, but I think they deserve to hear it from you on this Omega code. Wouldn't you like to see them again?
I reckon I would, but I had such a hell of a time escaping from Vivian last time, I don't like the thought of going through it again.
You've been on the frontier a 12 years, shooting and being shot at, and you expect me to believe you're scared of one helpless female?
Helpless? Hell! Give her a little encouragement and she'll follow you back to Washington.
Maybe I will. Are we going or not?
Nah, I reckon we'll go. I need to talk to Barnabas instead of writing him a letter.
Telegraph me from St. Louis when you're ready. I'll meet you there.
El Paso, Texas, December 17, 1881. Almost immediately following the ambush, Dallas Studenmeyer began looking with suspicion on men who seemed to have no means of support. Eventually, while Wes was having coffee in the Globe restaurant, Studenmeyer stopped at his table.
I've been seeing you around for a while, Pilgrim. You looking for work or just passing through?
Neither. While I really don't consider it any of your business, I gamble for a living. Any objection to that?
No, as long as you keep it honest. Frankly, I ain't seen many that can make a living without slick dealing. Maybe you're the exception.
Maybe I am. Until you get some complaints, why don't you just accept that as a fact?
Studenmeyer's face reddened and he walked away without another word. But wherever he found Wes, Studenmeier continued to eye him with suspicion. So Wes began playing an occasional hand of poker, winning more than he lost. It was in the Rio Grande Saloon that he first saw Frank Wooten and his daughter, Renita. Wooten had lost steadily, and Wes took the pot that cleaned him out.
Deal me in! I can cover it!
It was then that Wes became aware of the girl. She sat in a chair against the wall.
Give me the ring, girl!
No, it's my mama's.
Damn it, give me the ring!
Before he could grab the girl's hand to pull off the ring he wanted, Wooten found himself picked up by the collar and the seat of his pants and thrown through the batwing doors and out into the dusty street. The girl got to her feet. She was starvation thin, with auburn hair and big brown eyes. She fixed them on Wes as he returned to the table. Her nose dripping blood, she approached him.
Please, will you help me?
Liberty, Missouri, December 1st, 1881. Nathan spent 3 days with Silver, and when his friend departed, he rode to Liberty, the seat of Clay County, where Jesse James had been born. He expected hostility and ran headlong into it immediately and from a most unexpected source. He opened the door to the sheriff's office, and the tall, thin man who greeted him there wore a deputy's badge.
The sheriff's laid up sick. I'm Deputy Tobe Willis. What can I do for you?
I'm Nathan Stone, and I'm thinking of writing a book on Frank and Jesse James.
Oh, you don't look like no book writer to me. You look like one of them damn bounty hunters. Get out!
I'm no bounty hunter.
They all say that, and I'm telling you what I told the others. Get out!
Nathan rode to Epi Bolivar's boarding house, where he had often stayed before, and he was welcomed. He told Epi of his trouble with the deputy.
You're more fortunate than most. Two bounty hunters have been shot and killed. Shot in the back.
Well, I'm not bounty hunting.
No matter. Anybody asking about Frank and Jesse gets the same treatment. Two newspaper fellas were here from Chicago and were beaten within an inch of their lives. Pistol whipped. They spent a week in the hospital before they could leave.
For a pair of outlaws and killers, the James boys stand mighty tall.
I agree, but I have to keep my mouth shut. I'm too old and frail for a pistol whipping.
I haven't read the Kansas City papers for a while. What position are they taking toward the James gang?
Oh, they haven't taken a position. They mostly just report what happens, like the reporters from Chicago being beaten. Old wounds go deep, Nathan, and there are too many who remember that Frank and Jesse fought for the Confederacy.
Well, so did I. And I can understand why such feeling still runs high here in Missouri. But even if stealing and killing can be justified during the war, there's no logical and sensible way it can continue when the war's over.
Well, that's how I see it, but I dare not say it too loud, and neither should you. Why must you pursue Frank and Jesse? There's already an enormous reward, and if that's not enough, what can you do?
I don't know. I promised a friend for reasons that I can't tell you. I don't know that I can do anything, but I have to try.
El Paso, Texas, December 17th, 1881. Wes took the girl and led her out to a back alley.
Tell me where you live and I'll take you there.
No, he'll beat me.
He's your father?
My stepfather. My mama's dead. His name is Frank Wooten.
What's your name?
Renita.
Well, now, what am I going to do with you?
Take me with you. I can cook, clean, and wash.
I don't doubt you can. But if you have a father, even a stepfather, I may find myself in big trouble. How old are you?
17.
Not old enough. He'll have the law after us.
I'm not going back to him. If you don't want me, I'll run away.
I'll take you to my boarding house and get you a room. I don't see anything wrong with that. Wait here until I get my horse.
Can't I go with you?
No. My horse is tied in front of the saloon. I'll get him, and we'll ride down this alleyways.
Wes went back around the front to fetch his horse. He came back a few minutes later.
Did you see him?
Yes. And he's being taken to jail. He told the town marshal he had no place to stay tonight, and he's drunk.
He's always drunk. We slept in an old store building last night, and it had big rats.
I'll see that you do better than that. Here, I'll boost you up on my horse.
It was near supper time when they got to the boarding house, and Granny was in the kitchen. Molly Harrell met them in the front parlor.
Molly, this is Renita. She needs a room for a while. I'll pay for it.
Oh, well, she can have the room next to yours. That should be convenient for the both of you.
For a moment, she studied Renita, and the girl blushed, for she understood the implication of what Molly had said. Wes glared at Molly, took the key she offered, and without a word, led Renita down the hall.
Here's your key. Go in, lie down, and rest. I'll knock on your door at supper time, and we'll go to the dining room together.
No, I'm not fit. This is the only dress I have, and there's nothing under it, except me.
Your breakfast and supper is included in the price of the room, and you have to eat. You don't look like you've had a decent meal in a week.
Longer than that. Frank drinks and gambles his money away, when he has any. He sold 2 horses, and now he's broke again.
Where would the likes of him get horses to sell?
He stole them at a ranch north of here.
Go on in there and lock your door. Don't open it until I come back for you. My name is Wes.
Wes waited an hour before knocking on her door. He found Renita had used the wash basin and pitcher of water to good advantage. Her hair somehow looked better, and she had washed her face and hands. They reached the dining room a bit early and encountered Granny Boudlow.
Granny, this is Renita. I found her in town, and she has no place to go, so I paid Molly a month's room and board.
You good boy, Wes. Welcome, pequeño muchacha. You starved? You eat.
After seeing to it that Renita got a good, heavy meal, Wes took her back to her room.
Except for Granny. You know what they'll all be thinking, don't you?
Yes, and I don't care. I was starving, and I've had to fight Frank off me since before Mama died. You helped me when there was nobody else.
Suddenly, like a striking bird, she leaned forward and kissed him. Wes stood there a moment. He would be a while forgetting Rebecca Tuttle, if he ever did. But in this lonely girl he had befriended, there was a spark that was something more than gratitude. A spark that might become a flame. Sedalia, Missouri, January 2nd, 1882. Having spent a month in Missouri, Nathan had accomplished only one thing. He had been fired upon twice from ambush and had narrowly missed being hit both times. When he grew weary of sleeping on the ground and eating his own hurriedly cooked meals, he retreated to Eppy Bolivar's boarding house in Kansas City. There he rested, reading the Kansas City newspaper, seeking some clue that might help him solve a mystery that began to seem more and more impossible.
Nathan, you're not even sure that Jesse James is in Missouri. There is evidence aplenty that Frank and Jesse left the state for more than 4 years. What proof do you have that they're even here?
I've had my doubts, but if they're not here somewhere, why is everybody so damn hostile? I can't find them if they're not here, but I've already just missed being the guest of honor at 2 ambushes.
How long are you going to pursue this before giving it up as a lost cause? What is it going to accomplish for your friend if you're shot dead?
I'll give it a few more weeks. I hate to give up.
But all Nathan's enemies weren't friends of the James boys. Leaving Sedalia, he rode south to Springfield. He was just emerging from the newspaper office when he ran headlong into Amy Limbaugh. She looked older and harder, and her eyes were brimming with hate.
You!
Me? I was hoping while you were doing time you had bitten yourself and died of the poison.
You murdering bastard!
Well, I never shot anybody that wasn't shooting at me, and you know it.
I don't care what your reason was. You killed my brother, and I won't be satisfied until you're dead.
Then don't expect any slack from me because you're a woman. Come gunning for me, and I'll kill you as readily as I would if you were a man. Just remember, ma'am, I don't make threats. When I tell you something, take it as a promise.
Just then, Amy went for her gun, but Nathan was faster.
Oh!
Amy Limbaugh stood there with blood soaking the left side of her shirt. The sheriff was among the first to arrive, and all he seemed to see was Amy Limbaugh's bloody shirt. He drew his Colt, advancing toward Nathan.
Sheriff, I only defended myself. She went for her gun, and I can prove she served time for trying to ambush me in Jefferson City.
Well, I wasn't sheriff then, but I seem to recall the incident. Damn it, Amy. Ain't you learnt nothing?
Yes. I've learned if I want him dead, I'll have to kill him myself.
Mister, I'll take her to jail and have her patched up. I'll hold her until you've had a chance to leave town. Or you can press charges if you want. With her record, she'll go back to prison.
I'm not interested in sending her back to prison. When it comes to her learning anything, there's no hope for her. Save prison for those smart enough to learn from their mistakes.
Lock her up for a while, and if you have any influence with her family, tell them I won't spare her again.
El Paso, Texas, December 18th, 1881. Cautioning Renita to remain in her room, Wes rode to town the next morning after breakfast. He wanted to know if Frank Wooten had been released from jail and learned that he had been. By listening to talk, he also learned that Dallas Studenmeyer had ordered Wooten out of town, but nobody seemed to know where Frank Wooten was. Wes returned to Granny Boudlow's boarding house to find Renita watching for him, a question in her eyes.
He's been let out of jail and ordered out of town, and nobody seems to know where he is. We'll sit tight, and I'll have another look tomorrow.
The following day, Wes waited until near noon before riding into town. When he rode past the carpenter's shop, two men were putting the finishing touches on a coffin.
Who's it for?
Gent name of Wooten. Somebody found him strung up just north of here.
Where is he now? I used to know a man named Wooten.
He's at the undertaker's. They don't aim to plant him if the county won't pay.
Wes went and confirmed that it was indeed the body of Frank Wooten at the undertaker's office. Then he rode back to the boarding house and broke the news to Renita.
It's a terrible way to feel, but I'm glad he's gone. When I think of him, all I can recall is him hurting me.
I can't fault you for feeling that way. My mother died when I was born, and I never knew my father. When my grandparents, my mother's mother and father, were gone, I was sent to an orphanage. I ran away from there, and I've made my own way ever since.
Now that Frank Wooten's gone and can't come looking for me, may I stay with you?
I reckon, but I feel better if you are of age. How long until you'll be 18?
The 4th of next April. Not quite 3.5 months. Can't I just say that I'm 18 until I actually am?
It's not a bad idea. Might stop all these foolish looks we're getting in the dining room.
If I'm going to be 18, why can't we share the same room? They think we are already.
Do you think you're ready for that? Do you know what that means?
Yes, I know what it means, and I'm ready for it. Since I was 10, I've had to fight men who wanted me when I didn't want them. You're not like any of them. You were kind to me without asking anything in return.
I just don't want you believing you have feelings for me when it's only gratitude. I helped you because I saw your need, not to take advantage of you. You don't owe me anything. I'm a gambler. I'm not sure I'm much better than Frank Wooten was. Please keep that in mind.
I will not. Frank had a weakness for whiskey, and the more he drank, the worse his skill with the cards became. You don't drink whiskey, and you have money for food and a nice place to live. Frank never had that, and he killed my mama by being always on the move. He just wore her out, and he was wearing me out. Until I met you, I didn't care if I lived or died. You're young, but you're a man. Frank was much older, and he was never a man. I want to stay with you if you'll have me.
I'll answer that by taking you to town and buying you some new clothes. Horse and saddle, too, if you can ride.
I can ride, but I hate for you to spend so much on me. I'm not used to it. I never had new clothes, just Mama's hand-me-downs, and after she took up with Frank, not even that.
Nobody seemed to recall that Renita had been with Frank Wooten, and the trip to town was uneventful. Wes bought a bay horse and a saddle for Renita, and they stabled the horse alongside his. When they returned to the boarding house, Wes made it a point to seek out Granny Boudlow.
Granny, starting tonight, Renita's moving in with me, so we don't need the room she has. She has no family, and neither do I.
It's good. It's what we all expect.
They bypassed Renita's room, and Wes unlocked the door to his. He piled all their purchases on the bed and turned to the girl.
Do you want me to leave while you try them on?
No. You bought them, and you have the right to be the first to see me wear them. Besides, the bed's not that wide. We'll be...
a mite crowded.
The dress she wore was faded white in places, and Wes soon discovered that she wore nothing else. She tried on the different dresses, trying to see herself in the small oval mirror over the dresser.
How do I look?
Grand.
I feel like a queen. Which one should I wear for supper?
Your choice. You look wonderful in them all. I'm looking forward to us going to supper.
So am I, but not nearly as much as I'm looking forward to tonight. I can't tell you how long it's been since I've been able to lie down unafraid.
The day after Christmas, Jim Gillett resigned from the Texas Rangers. Wes spent a few minutes with Gillett after breakfast.
I'll be around El Paso for a while. I'm thinking of ranching.
Are you sure you want to raise stock this near the border?
Well, maybe not. The truth is, I have my eye on a woman, and she comes from a good family here in El Paso.
Good luck.
Kansas City, Missouri, March 31st, 1882. The first genuine lead Nathan eventually found was in a short paragraph he read in a Kansas City newspaper. A former member of the James Gang had been captured, and in a bid for a lighter sentence, had revealed that Jesse James was indeed living in Missouri as Thomas Howard. The outlaw had been captured near Marysville, Kansas. Nathan rode to a number of small towns in eastern Kansas, especially those that were county seats. There he pored over records of registered voters, spoke to newspaper editors, and sought courthouse records that might reveal men named Howard. Few being aware of the alias, there was no way of knowing the Thomas Howard Nathan sought was Jesse James, and so there was no hostility. Unfortunately, there was no Jesse James either. Not one of the Howards proved to be the man Nathan was seeking. Most were older men who had lived in the same house all their lives, while it was a known fact that Jesse James had left Missouri for at least 4 years. Since Nathan had taken Eppy Bolivar into his confidence, he often talked to her about his frustrations.
You don't know that Jesse's using an alias. This outlaw they captured may have just told the law what they wanted to hear.
I know. He may not be in Missouri either. I had hoped that if this varmint was telling the truth, that Jesse might be hiding somewhere near where this outlaw was captured. But if I keep moving in that direction, I'll have to go into Abilene, Wichita, and beyond. My God, it'd take me forever.
Then why not take some of the towns on the Missouri side? Most of the robberies took place in Missouri. And have you noticed that almost without fail, the James Gang never went too far from the scenes of their crimes?
Maybe you have something there, Eppy. I've been beating the bushes in Kansas when Jesse James is holed up in Missouri. There's only been one robbery by the James Gang since the shootout at Northfield in September of 76. On July 15, 81, a Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific train was boarded by the James Gang at Cameron and Winston. Both these towns are north of Kansas City, and both are in Missouri. Damn it, I should have started with them.
Oh, not necessarily. Both those towns are small towns. A man living under an alias should be in a town large enough that he doesn't attract attention to himself. Why don't you try St. Joseph?
Eppy, you're a caution. I've been too close to this thing. I'm going to St. Joseph, and if I draw a blank there, I'm going to give it up for a lost cause.
El Paso, Texas, March 1st, 1882. In the weeks following Jim Gillett's departure from the Rangers, Wes Tremaine spent most of his days in the various saloons, sharpening his skills as a gambler. It began to have its inevitable effect on Renita.
Why must you spend so much time in the saloons? I hate 'em.
Because I need to have something to do. El Paso was home to rustlers and outlaws from both sides of the border, and unless I obviously have some other way of making a living, I'll be suspected of being one of them.
Then let's go somewhere else.
That started a long talk, during which Wes told her the truth, that as a ranger he had been sent to this tumultuous border town.
What it all comes down to is that there's some kind of change in the wind. I aim to ride it out.
But Wes had begun making enemies, most of them among the men who lived on both sides of the border. In Mexico, they abided by no rules and wanted none. Armijo Barboncio's hand was quick with cards or a gun, and his quick temper made for an unholy trinity. Few Saturdays passed that didn't find him in El Paso's Acme Saloon, involved in a poker game. Wes had observed Barboncio's adeptness with the cards before and was virtually certain the man was cheating, but he wanted to take part in a game to be sure. The Saturday afternoon he sat in on a game, Dallas Studenmeyer was there and appeared to be the big loser. After yet another losing hand, Studenmeyer turned hard eyes on Barboncio.
Mex, if that's what you are, them cards is dancing to your tune a mite too often.
You are implying that I cheat, senor?
Implying, hell! I'm accusing you!
You will apologize, or I kill you.
I reckon I was wrong. My apologies.
Barboncio holstered his revolver and tipped back his sombrero. Studenmeyer slid back in his chair, got up, and quickly left the saloon. It was Barboncio's turn to deal, and with a smirk, he did so. When it came time to show their hands, Barboncio had a straight diamond flush.
By God, it's the first time I ever seen a man draw two damn straight flushes in one day.
It's not difficult when you're bottom dealing.
Armijo Barboncio went for his gun, but Wes was quicker than a rattler. Nobody bothered getting the marshal. Two bartenders removed Barboncio's body to his storage room near the back door. The game was over, and Wes was about to leave the saloon when he saw Jim Gillett near the back door. He walked over.
You put your foot in it, kid. The little sidewinder you shot was part of the Sandlin gang. You won't be safe anywhere in this town. They'll get you.
Maybe, but it had to be done. Studenmeier made me sick to my gut.
Studenmeier's finished as a lawman.
Who do you reckon will replace him?
Me, maybe. My name's in the pot.
You've been telling me how hell's gonna bust loose here at any time, and now you're wanting to take Studenmeier's job? Why?
Call it vanity, I reckon. Being a ranger, my hands were tied. I've had to play second fiddle to Studenmeier. I'll side you when I can, but watch your back.
To nobody's surprise, a little more than a year after becoming city marshal, Studenmeier resigned. Taking his place was former Texas Ranger Jim Gillett. St. Joseph, Missouri, April 4th, 1882. Nathan could barely believe it. He had read in the newspaper that very morning that Jesse James had been shot and killed by one of his own gang members, a man by the name of Robert Ford. He went to the telegraph office and sent a message to Byron Silver in Washington.
Jesse James, shot and killed in St. Joseph, April 3rd.
Nathan signed his name, paid for the telegram, and awaited an answer. He received it an hour later.
Meet me in St. Louis at Pioneer.